Welcome to The Near Memo, a weekly conversation about search, social, and commerce. What happened, why it matters, and the implications for local.
Hey everybody, we're back. It's David, Mike, and Greg talking about all things local and mostly Google. And this week we're going to be talking about the House Fresh Ranking Screed and its implications. We're also going to be talking about Google potentially unifying LSA and Google Business Profile reviews in a sort of single function. And then we'll be talking about the Department of Justice's closing slides or some of the closing slides in the antitrust case that just wrapped this week. So, Mike, why don't you lead us off with the LSA item?
Sure. So I've been in regular communication with some legitimate carpet cleaners in London who have been complaining about Google LSA spam in their marketplace, particularly fake reviews and fake review attacks. And they alerted me yesterday afternoon that LSA clients in England have been getting a notification that their customer, that their LSA customer review URL will expire on July 7th of this year, and that it will be replaced with the URL from GBP, and customer reviews in general will be managed from Google Business Profile, not the local service ads account. And once this change takes place, you must have an affiliated Google local business profile to run local service ads, and that the reviews will service on both local service ads and the Google Business Profile. So apparently they took my advice and decided to implement the Google Business Profile review filters, moderation process, all of that, which makes a tremendous amount of sense, given that the infrastructure was significantly more robust. Now, when I say that, you have to take all of that with a grain of salt, because I guess half of an orange is better than no orange. And the Google GBP review infrastructure is half an orange. But starting in 2022, GBP improved their review algo, their filtering algo. They put in place, subsequent to that, and later in 2023, a review moderation process where business can go and dispute reviews and appeal that process. And it was a formal process, and you actually got feedback and a case number. In the LSAs, they didn't have anything until last year when they finally implemented a form. You could use the form, but you got no feedback that the form was even received, let alone they were working on it. So you had no idea what was happening to these reviews. And the only way to possibly get a review taken down was to hammer that form multiple times with no feedback.
So, Mike, why don't you tell us why those two review universes were separate in the first place?
Because this speaks to the bigger question of how Google develops products in silos. You know, a team comes up with an idea. In this case, the idea was to produce a paid product that was that had verified businesses, verified reviews, that could clean up the cesspool that was home services in Google Local. And when they first rolled it out, of course, the businesses were heavily vetted and verified. The reviews were, in fact, verified reviews from persons who actually did business. As time went out, you know, so that was one silo. And instead of partnering up on parts of that, like the reviews, they did in Google, typical Google fashion. And also in typical Google fashion, they were pressured to scale this. And when they did, they reduced all of the vetting requirements and processes, and they reduced the strictness around reviews. So both ended up becoming totally rampant with spam.
And I would ask, my guess would be that the person or team involved in setting the product up moved to another division at Google to advance their careers inside of Google. And so there's no institutional knowledge left on the LSA team about the potential for review fraud. So,
right. So who knows? I mean, again, reflects.
Those jobs Google have been outsourced to Mexico now, David.
as has the review process been outsourced to India. So it reflects how Google does business. You know, they had a lot of knowledge about review abuse. They knew this was coming. They did it anyways. They built it a crappy product. It appears that either through cost cutting or some forced merging, or perhaps the law, I don't know. You know, UK and in Europe in general, Google has more responsibility around the reviews. and perhaps that has precipitated this change. We don't know that it's going to be rolled out globally. It's likely that it will, because it makes sense that it's an integrated single system. It would make even more sense if they devoted real resources to it and continued to improve it, particularly both the algorithm and the moderation process. But it just so speaks to how Google builds these things in a vacuum because of, you know, engineer interest, and then keeps them in a silo, and they have to perform up to a certain level. Either they get capped or they get nuked. And so typically you don't see cross-team development, which is a tragedy, because this was a perfect opportunity for that and didn't happen. And there's been a lot of abuses as a result.
No. Yeah, the idea that Google can create mediocre products and sort of let them ride without consequences, it speaks to their status as a, you know, as a monopoly in the market. But that's, we'll get to that in a little bit.
Right. Historically, LSA reviews were sort of market driven. Initially, they had to be associated with a real business. That sort of fell away. Now they are going to once again, starting I think from this March, but through this process in the UK, they're being forced to be associated with a Google My Business listing. So there's some vetting of the veracity of the business on two levels. But then again, I read today from Chris Barnard that they've reduced any requirements around where you can show an LSA ad. So with this contraction of users and Google is sort of trying to expand where you can show an ad. So particularly in legal, that's likely to lead to, you know, a huge escalation of pricing, like in the legal space. Being, you know, a California lawyer can work in any place in California, and they can't show their GBP any place in California. So being able to show an LSA ad anywhere in California would be a very powerful advertising vehicle.
Well, to which Google says, "Oh darn, what an unfortunate outcome."
Yeah. Yes. So Google gives and Google takes it away. Their development process historically sucks, and this just shows it.
All right. So speaking of taking away, HouseFresh, a small product review site focusing on air purifiers and home environment hygiene, got a lot of attention for a post about kind of ranking that they did a couple of months ago, and they're back with another one. What does it say, David?
Basically that the situation's gotten even worse. They've clearly been a victim of one of these, one of the recent algorithm updates. And I think that's, you know, it is somewhat surprising. I guess I would have expected that maybe the product team at Google, would have been a little bit more, not sensitive to HouseFresh's particular problem, but this perception broadly that they're not surfacing enough hidden gems, of which HouseFresh theoretically is one, and that the latest update actually, at least in the case of HouseFresh, made the situation worse. We don't know how broadly applicable that is, whether other niche sites around the web have experienced a similar decline as HouseFresh, but I would say anecdotally, it feels like at the very least, the situation has not improved for sort of niche sites that clearly demonstrate a high degree of the EEAT variables that Google is purportedly looking for with their algorithm. So I guess this article struck me. First of all, this is nothing I'm saying is meant to disparage either HouseFresh or the author. I thought it was absolutely terrific post. Really well, lays out just very, very well exactly what is happening in a lot of these sort of product review search results, where, you know, these massive publishing houses, in many cases owned by private equity companies, are just leveraging the strength of their domain to publish articles in spaces that they know are highly popular. There's a lot of search volume, and that they're largely profitable in terms of either getting eyeballs, if that's how they monetize, or in some cases, you know, through affiliate links or some other way of monetizing. So basically the sort of domain strength plus good SEO, good keyword research, is sort of ruining the search results in HouseFresh's domain. And again, this is not meant to disparage the article. If anything, I thought it was a very clear narrative of exactly how this is happening. However, this has been happening for, I would say, at least 7 or 8 years, possibly longer, depending on exactly what niche you're in, where, you know, I mean, Eric Schmidt said it as far back as I think it was 2012 right. in his one of his testimonies that brands are how you sort out the cesspool of the internet. So Google has long favored these large brands. And I think that the two things have probably happened. Number one, it's now, thanks to AI, it's now much cheaper to produce content at scale. Number two, I actually think that there's just many more brands who understand the power of SEO today versus 10 years ago and understand just how much of an asset their domain strength is and their brand strength is. And so they're getting smarter about monetizing that asset. And I don't think that that's a new thing. I feel like that strategy has been in place for, you know, close to a decade. And what is new is that this article has sort of put a spotlight on exactly what that strategy is. And I think I asked this question on LinkedIn, you know, why is this article getting so much attention now? And I think people that both Rand Fishkin and Miriam Ellis, friends of the pod, commented that they feel like this is sort of a concrete example of something that people have been feeling for the last 2, 3, 4 years. And that's why it sort of crystallizes the narrative is why it's gotten so much play.
Right. It seems like a sort of a metaphor or an instance of a much larger phenomenon. I mean, you know, one of the things that's really true about this, as you say, is how well documented it is, you know, how sort of cynical these larger brands are. And there's also the phenomenon.
Is it cynical or is it smart business? I don't think it's
well,
cynical.
No. So I would argue that it's a totally rational response to Google's algorithm, right? That's what I said in the newsletter, that I hate Forbes. I think Forbes is a shitty publication. They've destroyed the brand with their, you know, their strategy. But it was a rational response to what Google was doing, right? You know, there's a crisis in traditional publishing. What are they going to do? This is a totally rational response, and it's paid off for them in a big way. The other thing, in addition to sort of the brand favoritism, is the user engagement. AJ Cohn's article, you know, Google Enough talks about how people respond to brands. They're familiar. They click on the brand links. That reinforces the ranking, you know, the ranking position of these brands. So it's like this vicious cycle where you get the brands strategizing around Google's algorithm for revenue, you know, which they absolutely need to survive, and then the consumer response to that. So it's just all of these things coming together in this example. And you've also got in some cases the parasite SEO, and you've got site reputation and views and parasite SEO are sort of the same thing.
But to some extent, the problem is the business plan of this company, right? I mean, we've said this for years. The reality is you have to own your relationship with your client. And if you're arbitraging Google to make a living, it's a very precarious
business proposition. Yeah.
It's a failing proposition sooner or later. I don't know how these people make their living, but it just strikes me that they have been hit by, you know, they were in this arbitrage game as much as anybody else. They're losing where they were winning. And, you know, it just points out the problem with relying on Google for your income.
Well, these are magazines in many cases. I know, David, you wanted to talk about site reputation abuse. These are magazines in some cases, you know, Condé Nast, whoever owns Good Housekeeping.
Dot Dash Meredith was the example that you brought up.
Yeah, Dot Dash Meredith. And magazine, nobody's buying physical magazines. I mean, you know, magazines are still around, but they don't have anything like the revenue with subscription revenue, the ad revenue they used to have. So you have to turn to digital sources. They don't have enough scale to create their own ad networks, although some people are trying to do that. So what are their options? You know, they're
going to a different line of business. Well, become a plumber. I mean, it doesn't matter. The reality is, if it's not a good line of business because Google has destroyed it, it's not a good line of business because Google has destroyed it. Now, whether Google should be allowed to destroy lines of businesses is another question.
The newspaper industry, right? This is an adjacent thing. Same problem, but that's a different discussion.
Well, but again, you know, they were overcharging, under delivering on quality of ads, or many of them were. And so, yeah, Google came in and produced a much cheaper, much more effective product, put them all out of business. You know, whether Google should be allowed to do that, but listening to HouseFresh reminds me of listening to Yelp. I mean, you know, Yelp has made this transition away from their need for Google traffic to some extent successfully, despite their grumping all along the way. And they've been profitable by changing how they do business. And I think in the end, any business that wants to survive can't rely on Google.
I agree. David, what were you going to say about
that? Well, a couple things. And first of all, the author said, you know, she explicitly said Google doesn't know HouseFresh anything. She's well aware of that sort of as a starting point. But you're right, Mike, that there seems to not be maybe quite as much exploration of alternative business models. You know, can you invent a widget that attaches to an air purifier that tells you, you know, how efficient it is relative to other air purifiers in the network, you know, something like that. There's got to be something else that HouseFresh can do outside of relying on Google for traffic. Okay. Two other things I wanted to bring up as part of this article. The first is these guys are particularly at the mercy of an increasing number of PLAs and organic shopping results in the overall SERP, which this site is probably not eligible for. I don't know that to be specifically true. I don't know whether they carry inventory or not, but the emergence of these very rich image focused, price focused ads and organic units has probably caused a huge decrease in traffic. I won't say it's as much as the sort of brand dial getting turned to 11, but it's these two factors are converging with respect to any product site that doesn't actually carry products. I think increasingly Google is looking to send traffic to people who are eligible for Merchant Center, whether that's intentional or not. That is clearly what the outcome of these new SERP elements are or is. So that's the first thing I'd say. And then the second thing, Greg, you brought up the sort of relationship to the parasite SEO site reputation abuse policy. And Google now has rolled that out, whatever, a couple days ago in early May of 2024. I find it very, very interesting that they started with a manual version of this. That tells me that they are not confident that their algorithm can actually do this at scale. Mike has documented for years how loath Google is to do anything that can't scale. And this to me is a serious admission of the weakness of their algorithm in identifying what topics a site should be relevant for. And so I don't know where this goes, but if they keep doing manual actions, it is a very bad sign for the quality of the search quality team today.
Well, I mean, there's the issue of the third party relationship with the domain that has the authority, right? The coupon sites are the example of that. But who is Google to decide what the particular site should be covering or writing about? I mean, this, you know, Google's determination of, you know, you're a such and such a publication, you should write about these three things and not about these other things. I mean, there's a lot of spam on these sites, but who is Google to make that determination at all? I mean, they should not be making that determination. Now, well, having said that,
it's their sandbox. I think they should be allowed to do what they want. But I think it is, as more people get frustrated by the low quality of the results and Google keeps scrambling behind the scenes to edit them by hand, to me, that is a losing proposition, especially if someone like ChatGPT comes along with a better mousetrap. So,
well, I mean, Google's entitled to rank people how it wants to rank people, but it shouldn't be dictating the terms of editorial coverage to a publication. I mean, I guess it's up to the publication to take the consequences if they want to persist in their behavior. But all right, so we're done on that topic?
Yes, okay. Sir.
All right.
Over to you.
All right. So let's move on to, you know, since we're sort of tiptoeing around the edges here of Google's status as a monopoly abusing its market position. Let's talk about the DOJ slides. The Department of Justice gave its closing argument, as did Google, in the long-running antitrust case. It's been around for 3+ years. that tackles a number of topics, one of which is the default search relationships with Apple and Mozilla, and a couple of others are in there, the legitimacy of that, and then also its advertising products. There were some other issues in there. And the DOJ released some slides that constituted its closing argument around the paid search advertising and PLAs to some degree. And it was a 143-slide presentation, and it was pretty interesting. I had been personally focused on the Apple relationship and the 20-plus billion that Google's giving to Apple and others to maintain those default search relationships. But this was entirely about price fixing, or how Google manipulates prices in the auction in order to maintain and grow revenues against the backdrop of what might otherwise happen in the market if they didn't raise prices artificially. And there was a lot of testimony at the trial by Jerry Dischler and others about
Hold it. These are better prices. They're not higher prices. Oh, they happen to be higher prices, but better they're better prices.
They're more, Mike, they're more fair. They're not necessarily higher. They're more fair. That was the line.
So
from,
for context,
from
this was an answer from
Dr.
the VP of product.
Dr. Adam Judah, VP of product. Yes.
I would describe it as less
higher
as
prices
raising
are not
prices
higher.
And
they're
more,
more
coming
fair.
Up with
yeah.
Well,
more
the,
fair
the,
prices.
The deck is really striking when you go
Very
through
striking.
It. When you go through it, you really, it's a pretty compelling argument that Google is manipulating prices, raising prices, not being transparent with advertisers, and doing so explicitly to meet its quarterly numbers or, you know, to please Wall Street. And they don't care about competition. I mean, one of the things that people misunderstand is that it's not illegal to be a monopoly. It's illegal to abuse that power, right? So that's what Google is being charged with. And so price fixing or price manipulation, which is one of the classic issues in these monopoly cases, prices are raised for the consumer, the end user, is really what they're going after here. And it's, in my view, it's a pretty compelling argument.
And most also compelling, but at meta level, was their ability to show that search advertising, as opposed to social or display advertising, was a unique market
yes.
that Google uniquely controls, and which businesses are not going to shift their money from
right.
search to display or social. Those are separate
right.
advertising budgets. I thought that was a particularly effective
yeah.
argument as well.
The point there is that, oh, go ahead, David.
The whole slides made me stand up and cheer as a U.S. taxpayer that my tax dollars funded the salaries of the people who created this document. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I thought they just nailed Google to the wall on every single point. It was very clearly laid out, even for people who are not in this space. I thought it was just a terrific rhetorical narrative that I hope leads to some real action. So,
yeah, to your point, Mike, the issue is, who, you know, is there competition? Is there competition in the space? And what Google was and what the DOJ was arguing was that you cannot substitute other kinds of ads for search ads. So that advertisers are compelled or more or less compelled to keep spending on Google. Google doesn't have any effective competition in search advertising. You can't just go into display advertising or product listing ads or social media and cover yourself if you pulled out of Google. And there were a bunch of advertiser testimonials in there saying this is always on advertising. It's essential. And it's, you know, it's essentially foundational to our program. So I agree with you, David. It was a really good, really strong presentation. And, you know, the judge seems, you know, some of the people that were reporting on the hearing said that the hearing was sort of inconclusive from their point of view because the judge seemed to be poking holes in both sides' arguments and challenging both sides. I believe there will be a finding of liability on some of the counts or some of the claims against Google. And the real question is, what does the DOJ or what does the court do about, not the DOJ, but what does the court do about that? What is the remedy here? And we'll have to wait and see. It's going to be a couple of months at least before we get that outcome. And it can be appealed, of course.
And I'm sure will be. I think Google's, now we learned from our friends in the EU that Google's been appealing the shopping case for like 10 years in the EU, and it's still
right.
unresolved. So clearly cheaper for
yes.
Google to pay lawyers that long than actually pay the fine. So
right, because, I mean, the revenue keeps you know, keeps rolling in during that
right.
the pendency of the appeal, and that and whatever bad practice was happening probably doesn't get suspended, you know, or discontinued. It's a Trump-like delay strategy, it seems to me. So,
well, Trump is using a Google-like delay strategy.
Yes, right. So
Google employed this strategy before he was a candidate. So
that's right.
That's right. Trump has learned from Google. All right. So I think that brings us to the end of this week's discussion. Obviously, there's a lot more to talk about, but we're out of time for today. And thank you very much for joining us. Tell your friends and come back next time.
Thanks for joining David, Mike, and Greg. To stay on top of the latest developments in local, subscribe to our newsletter at nearmedia.co. We'll see you next week.